How can design accelerate the shift to a circular economy? This is what I'm going to discuss with Jonquil Hackenberg, CEO of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation.
Design Perspectives, the podcast of the German Design Council. Today with host Martin Pauli.
Welcome to this new episode of Design Perspectives, a podcast format of the German Design Council. My name is Martin Pauli. This is a special episode, and I'm really excited to be joined by one of the most forward-thinking voices in sustainability and circular transformation today. Jonquil Hackenberg is a global leader in climate and circular economy strategy, with a career spanning more than 20 years across business transformation, consulting, and environmental innovation. From her work at Infosys and PA Consulting to her current leadership at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, Jonquil has consistently pushed organizations to rethink value creation, embrace long-term thinking, and move from linear to regenerative models. Her approach challenges us to see sustainability not as an add-on, but as a strategic and human imperative that reshapes how we design, produce, and live. Welcome, Jonquil.
Thank you, Martin.
So you've spent more than two decades working at the intersection of business transformation and sustainability. What originally sparked this for you?
I guess as a career consultant before I joined EMF, my focus had always been with clients to give value, and value increasingly meant for me kind of sustainability, actually. That's what it meant. So that was one thing, but I didn't really know anything about it many years ago. So my first degree was in languages, actually in German and Italian literature. And then I decided that my religious medieval German poetry semester probably wasn't going to cut it in the boardroom. So I actually did an MBA at Beuth Hochschule in Berlin, which is focused on renewables. And I basically then merged everything together. So the stuff I learned about renewables and consulting and supply chains and complex transformation, I merged those two things together. And that's where I ended up focusing heavily on sustainability and now circular economy.
So looking back, were there special moments early in your career that made you realize that sustainability had to become central? Because you could have had a lot of focuses, but you wanted to double down on that.
Yeah, I think I did a lot of work in big, complex change underpinned by technology. And so really focusing from the business lens. And to me, logically, supply chains in particular were being increasingly impacted. You could just see that by climate change. You could see that by resilience, just in general, of availability of supply. And so logically, all of that came together to say this needs to be a real focus, actually. It's not about only tech-led. It has to be led by both a societal and environmental lens.
And what keeps you personally motivated in that field? I mean, we are all... it's easy to be overwhelmed, let's put it that way. There is a journey of sustainability. You know, there have been very early conversations about it, and also about sustainable value creation. Then there were the UN SDGs, and there were kind of constantly new agendas that were added. And sometimes you had a feeling there's a new flavor of the month, if you like. So what keeps you motivating, and how do you navigate that complexity?
I couldn't agree more. It's completely overwhelming, isn't it? So for me, this is why I love the circular economy, because it's A, it's really logical, B, it's apolitical, and C, you know, it's about how do you create enough feedstock and keep it in circulation so that you can innovate and create value out of waste. And I'm really excited by that, really. I'm excited by, it's not about recycling, it's about doing so much more than that and thinking of clever and creative ways of the waste of one industry is the value of another. And I just think it gives so much opportunity globally to rethink how we do stuff. And so for me, that's what gets me excited. I'd also say at this point in time, you know, we're at the end of 2025, which has been a tumultuous year. I love the fact that it's apolitical. It provides a narrative that cuts through controversial words. You know, it's about resilience. It's about, you know, electrification. It's about all the things. It's about waste. It's all these things that are really critical for us moving forward without having to worry about what politics is going to say or destroy about it. And so that's why I'm really excited by it.
Well, I absolutely share that excitement, and I also couldn't agree more. And of course, it's about the economy, you know, I mean, the aspect of value creation, however, and ideally decoupled from the resource extraction and all that. So from your perspective, where is the global transition to a circular economy actually? How's it progressing? And where is it still stuck? I mean, I know it's a complex question, but...
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been at Ellen MacArthur Foundation for 1 year now in situ as the CEO. And so I guess looking at the 14 years of amazingness that happened before I arrived, what was really apparent, the goal had always been to get circular economy out there in terms of governments and in terms of businesses. And so what that resulted in, and not exclusively through us, but through a lot of the work that EMF has done, is, you know, we've got close to 90 countries that have circular economy roadmaps and 45% of businesses, or even 55% of businesses. But the thing is, it's not yet real. And so what we're doing, and where I think it's really stuck or has been stuck, is you've got tax incentives that are rewarding the linear model. You've got an increasing number of pilots all over the place that mean that you never get the scale that reduces the price to make it economically viable. And you've got political headwinds because we've been trying lots of different things. So what we're focusing on is three big areas. And the reason we've chosen these three areas, which I'll come to in a minute, is because there is a nexus of business and policy. It's a macro trend or focus right now, and circular economy is perceived as part of the solution. And so out of those three things are plastics and packaging, and we can talk more about that. The second is critical minerals, with entry points around EV batteries and consumer electronics. And the third is fashion and textiles. And so those are the three areas that we're focusing on, because we see real opportunity at a policy level, but also at an innovation level to address both recycling of feedstock, but the innovation of the offtake as well.
Yeah, really glad to dive into those three areas in a minute. Looking at the organizations and the businesses you mentioned, what are the biggest misconceptions that you as an organization, but also you individually, encounter when those organizations talk about going circular? Because, I mean, there has been also a bit of a trend. And sometimes as a circular economy expert, you get a feeling that this might be maybe even a very narrow understanding of circularity. What's your view on that?
Great question. I'm so glad you're asking me this question. So generally, most people think that circular economy equals recycling. Which is really frustrating, because it's like missing out on the whole value creation, as you mentioned, right? It's missing out on that whole upstream design. So that's kind of one of the biggest misconceptions. You know, if you recycle, then we've solved the world's problems. And I'd say that then gets us stuck, because there isn't enough value seen in that. And if we can create the value, particularly around critical minerals, because it's high value, comparatively low volume, then we're really changing the game, which is quite exciting. So that's one big misconception. The other thing is, until very recently, I would say circular economy has always been thrown into the bucket of environment and sustainability, which isn't bad, but it's really limiting, because it is about the economy, right? Mm-hmm. It's about the economy, and it's about creating an economy that is not repeating the limitations of a linear economy, like unnecessary extraction benefiting the global north. It's really about rethinking how do we design this so the global south can level up. And for me, those are the things that, you know, we really need to focus on, which should be getting people excited about how to solve for it.
And it's interesting. I mean, one of my observations is when it comes to organization, it really depends how long they are in the business, obviously. For organizations that have established linear practices over decades and decades and have massive investment horizons ahead of them, it's, of course, much more difficult. Whereas you sometimes see smaller organizations that are there for 10 years and you look at their circularity maturity and you're super impressed. So I think I know it's a tough question, but you mentioned also the transition from individual pilots, small-scale pilots, towards scale. And at the moment, the lack of also that economy of scale, which is often impacting on the viability. Is there one leverage point that kind of that could unlock that? I mean, we're talking about a systemic transition, or probably not, but...
So I'd say there's two leverage points there, actually. I mean, there's many, many more if you go down, but the two leverage points are, one is collective advocacy. So how do we, you know, put aside all the shopping list or Christmas list, seeing as we're recording this almost before Christmas, of all the things that we might want to have in a policy, and just align on what makes most sense as guidelines. That would unlock so much. It would unlock, and by policy, I mean tax incentives or rewards or tax breaks even for being able to do things in a circular manner. And the second thing is collective action. So we're moving towards that. So we've got some projects running. We looked at our network of companies that we have, and we looked at what we're focusing on. And we also asked our network, how many projects have you got going in plastic packaging, for example? And we heard that there were lots of different projects happening. So we said, well, let's stop doing that and let's do a top-down, bottom-up approach. Let's look at which countries have the enabling conditions, so the policies and the tax breaks and the tax incentives. Which countries overlaid have the largest problems or challenges around waste, and then bottom up, which companies within our network are across those geographies and countries, and let's just focus on very explicitly which countries and which solutions, which then stops money being thrown away for vanity projects and really rather focusing on scale. And that's really where we've moved to this year.
I guess you guided a lot of companies through major sustainability shifts, and you still do that also in your current role. What would you say, what distinguishes leaders who kind of really succeed and who are really front runners from those that are kind of more the followers or the laggards?
A couple of things. One, which sounds trite, but it's really true, is bravery, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got to be brave. You've got to be brave to say, there is no other way to do this. This is a long-term problem unless we start to address it now, irrespective of what's happening with politics and trade tariffs and all of those things. So it's being brave and staying the course and having an ability to meet the realities of today whilst having the future in mind. So I think that's one really, really big thing. And bravery is easier if you're then in a collective of organisations who are then working on collective advocacy and collective projects, because then you're not sticking out on your own. And we provide that, which is great. And we're not the only organisation that does, but I think that really, really helps. So I think bravery is one thing. And I think also just looking at, it's kind of a subset of bravery, is to say, particularly around economic viability of alternative solutions that benefit the environment, you have to collaborate with your competitors. You have to. It's non-negotiable, because you're never going to get the economy of scale on your own. And so you have to be brave enough to say, this is my unique selling point and I can still do that, even if I have exactly the same alternative packaging solution by working with my competitors with the same material, I can still design it in a different way. And that's really important. So this pre-competitive IP lens and separating it out from your core business is also important. And then one last thing, sorry, is actually putting circularity or sustainability, depending on your focus, let's call it decarbonisation and circularity, at the centre of your business strategy. And we're starting to see two things happening depending where you sit in the world. One is organisations that are starting chief sustainability officers under their CFOs as a reporting requirement, which is so disappointing after so much progress. And yet on the other side, you see China and the UAE decoupling circular economy from their environmental policy because they see it as an economic lever. So that's the things that need to happen.
Fantastic. That was epic. And I just quickly wanted to, because I can really relate to the collaboration aspect, that's also something that we see in our practice, which is a big shift. No, I mean, historically, organizations, companies were really focused on securing their IP and being very almost defensive when it comes to competition and whatnot. But now they realize that if they want to get to that economy of scale and to viability of certain business models, as you say, they have to start collaborating upstream and downstream. And this is a very promising sign. And wherever we see that, we also see that those new models, those new products or business models really flourish. On the economic side, I mean, of course, that's one of the key tensions and usually always the elephant in the room, kind of tension between short-term and long-term thinking. So, I mean, how do you help organizations and partners move from short-term to long-term thinking and also long-term value creation?
So there's a couple of lenses there. One is crucially narrative. So it's finding a narrative that is apolitical that allows you to keep doing what you were doing. For example, biodiversity and climate are controversial words in some circles. Nature is not. Everybody loves nature. Waste is a safe word. Pollution is not necessarily, but clean air is a good word. Electrification is good. Decarbonisation is controversial. Resilience is good. Other words aren't. So finding the parallel words that cut through the noise and focus on the economics is as complex and as simple as that. And that just allows progress to flourish. And the second thing is action. You said right at the beginning of this, and you are so right. We talked about how we've got all these sustainable development goals, and then you've got lots of different reporting metrics, and it just became this spaghetti alphabet soup of complexity, people using bigger and bigger words. And actually, the best thing we can do is, of course, have action. So being able to point to a solution to say people aren't walking through waste anymore because it's being collected and being reused, that's a good thing. So the faster we can start to point to projects that will deliver a long-term benefit, the better. And yeah, So those are the two things we need to do.
Very clear. Again, I really, really like that. One last thing before we move on to design. You mentioned that in an ideal world, one of the success factors is that sustainability, or whatever kind of how organization called it for themselves, is at the heart of the strategy, of the business strategy. Do you still see that sustainability departments operate in different silos? And what can companies and organizations do to somehow enable that integration rather than that separated model?
So I'd say that the leaders are integrating. They're integrating really, really well. I mean, you see plenty of examples of that, of the 200-ish organizations in our network, because it's thinking through, how do I design out waste? I mean, if you just start as a simplistic example of how do I reduce my waste, whether that's energy consumption, whether that's material flows, that's just the basis. It doesn't really matter whether you're a service provider or a products producer, right? That's why it makes logical sense. Anything on the side just then becomes admin and overhead. So then it's an additional cost. And so those companies that are parking it just under the CFO because it's just another reporting requirement are missing a trick. They're missing the opportunity of saving on waste and creating value and new value streams.
You mentioned the word design, obviously, a lot already in the context of circularity and innovation. So it's clear that it plays a huge role in shaping the products, but also designing behaviors, designing systems, designing operating models, you name it. What role do you see for designers in driving the circular economy?
I mean, I'm
easy
also
question.
Biased on design. Easy question. I'm also biased on design because I'm, you know, vice chair of the Design Council in the UK as well. I mean, design, it's central to this. It's like absolutely critical to this. Like, design manifests in so many different ways in every single industry. Design has to be about, if you're rethinking, if you're trying to design out waste or recreate value in a different way, design's at the center of it. It's thinking differently. And that manifests, of course, in physical changes. It's things like, let's take the car industry, seeing as that's so close to the German Design Council as well. So that the car industry, think about redesigning ownership models of batteries. Does the end consumer, car driver, do they need to own the battery? No. So imagine owning the car, but replacing the battery, but the ownership of the battery and the critical minerals sits at the center with the OEM or even the mining company. And so designing that and thinking that through is absolutely critical to this and creates so much excitement and opportunity. And I think if you overlay the lens of environment as well, whether it's for packaging or if it's for the product itself or behavioral change, it's central to everything we do. So I only see it being on the rise.
Yeah. And it's interesting also how kind of broadly you look at design. As you said, it goes far beyond the product design, of course, or the small system. It is about the entire potential value chain ownership models. So it is a much more comprehensive view. Has that also evolved? I mean, when I got in touch with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation many years back, I remember that IDEO also played a huge part in that collaboration. And they also framed it as one of the biggest design opportunities of our time. Has that thinking evolved? No, I mean, listening to you. But where do you see design still being an underused lever for circularity today?
I think people don't understand the opportunity with design. I think design is such a catch-all word. It's a bit like sustainability, or it's a bit like digital, right? So it's, what do we mean by design? And I think figuring out what the main thing we mean in terms of products, in terms of services, in terms of behaviors, and citing examples in those will then inspire future designers and indeed organizations to really put design at the center of everything. But I think that's the problem. It's like this catch-all word that means everything and nothing.
So looking at your focus, like the renewed focus of EMF in also relation to circular innovation and innovative design-led approaches, how can design focus on those three focus fields shape the direction of the organizations that are involved and all the partners and the stakeholders that you mentioned?
Well, maybe we've talked a little bit about plastics, about critical minerals, and we can cover those again or not. But let's talk maybe about fashion textiles, close to everybody's heart. We all wear clothes, right? So if we think about where design could play a role there, so a few different lenses, designing the secondhand market for clothes, which is increasingly popular, certainly with my children. Absolutely love, you know, Vinted as a platform for resale. But there's so much more you can do. So again, this would be a perfect example. And in fact, we're working on the fashion remodel at the moment around creating and designing circular business models where repair might make more sense in one part of the textile industry, whereas rent might make more sense in another, or resale, depending where you're sitting. You still get your USP, but the point is that if it's been used secondarily, imagine designing, again, design policy that means you pay less VAT for secondhand goods, which is not the case today. Uh-huh. So thinking policy to enable different ways of redesigning how materials are reused. And then secondly is thinking about designing circular economy and bioeconomy policies to swap out synthetic materials with nature-based materials, again, by designing trade incentives and trade flows in different ways. You know, imagine being discounted for using upcycled goods or using nature-based products versus being incentivized to be using synthetic goods to have it cheap as possible. So thinking through all of those different aspects, you've got loads of different design opportunities, product designers, policy designers, service designers, and behavioral scientists, of course, is central to this.
So if I'm a young designer now listening to the podcast and I'm not quite sure where to focus my career, is there one piece of advice that you can give how they can contribute more meaningfully to, for instance, circularity? And what would that advice be?
Pick your passion, right? pick the thing that you care about most. Is it the built environment? Do you care about buildings and architecture? Do you care about getting from A to B and travel? Do you care about new materials? Do you care about behaviours? Do you care about coming up with new ideas and new business models? Think about that as your secondary lens and then overlay design with it and stick. And basically, you're in three categories of product, service, or behaviour. It's one of those three that you're going to be ending up doing at a very simplistic level. That would be my advice.
Yeah, no, very good. And I can confirm that also personally. It works. So as someone who leads also teams, what capabilities will future leaders need that today's leaders sometimes lack to really navigate those future challenges and the complexity?
Do you know, we were talking about this the other day. It's really actually another person from Berlin, or Potsdam, which is very funny, where we met in Abu Dhabi. And we're talking about what do future leaders need and how do you spot good future leaders? I'd say one lady in the conversation, she said listening. And that sounds trite, but it's really important. Like listening to different perspectives and being able to be agile in your thinking and being able to adapt really quickly is super key. Like that is super key, that agility, a deep understanding, if not in practice, but of the opportunity of AI. It doesn't, and understand the warnings of AI as well to see how you can embed that into the thinking of everything. I think really just having a lens that has a social lens and an environmental lens, not just purely an economic lens. And, you know, circular economy gives you all of those three without having to think about three things all at once.
And how do we prepare then that next generation of leaders to navigate climate and biodiversity, circularity? With, you mentioned the word courage earlier, or no, being brave,
yeah,
rather than fear. So embracing the upcoming change rather than being defensive.
We've just got to keep sharing positive stories, right? It's as simple as that. Like, it's so much doom and gloom, the end of the world is nigh, you know, it's the world's going to explode and get too hot. I mean, how is that motivational in any way to do anything about it? It feels impossible. So we just need to stop doing that. And we need to start telling and pointing to solutions rather than to words, and making it as simple as possible and talking like we're talking to three-year-olds, because if we don't, that's the leveler that everybody understands, and we need to stop being so clever with our words. It just needs to be simple language and solutions.
Yeah, no, I really couldn't agree more. It's about, I don't know, having a positive vision of the future and then, but also understanding that we can actually design that. We can take active steps towards achieving that rather than just letting it happen. So I think that is really something that resonates well with me. You worked also a lot about inclusive culture, and the way you communicate is also very inclusive. Is that essential for a sustainable transformation?
100% essential. If we're only talking from one perspective, we're never going to change things. We're never going to change the system. If we look at circular economy, or indeed sustainability as a whole, it's still quite one-dimensional in the sense that it's still very global north focused, that the global north thinks they know better than the global south. And we have to be careful that AI is not just simply replicating what's in the system already, and that we include those voices, those practices, those behaviours that are completely natural in India or Indonesia or Thailand or Brazil that aren't in a system because they're not considered at the moment. And that to me is the biggest danger of AI, is that we don't have that kind of balance of the global south perspective as well, where there's a myriad solutions every single day.
That's probably a perfect segue to the kind of the final block, which is hopefully a bit forward looking. What's like one assumption about the future that you believe we need to challenge more boldly? Is that AI will take over parts of our system?
Yes, I think we, again, it's like everything we have at the moment is so polarizing, isn't it? It's like either the world's going to end or the world's going to be amazing, or deep sea mining is the only way to go, or deep sea mining is the end of our oceans as we know it. There's nothing balanced in the middle. And I think that's stemmed from fear and lack of understanding. AI presents such an amazing opportunity for us to advance solutions faster, so long as we have that lens of, well, let's overlay the human intelligence too. And so I think we have to challenge the assumption that AI isn't going to solve everything, that humans aren't irrelevant, and that how can it help and what do we need to also counter it?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a mechanism almost, that the more complex and volatile the world gets, the more we tend to, as you say, polarize and see things black and white, even though the beauty is, I guess, in all the nuance that is connected to all these problems. Is there one project or one initiative, John Quill, that gives you genuine hope right now?
We've got lots of projects going on. I guess the genuine hope is seeing, you know, setting out strategies and solutions of, for example, we're identifying a city in Brazil through philanthropic funding of what city of about 5 million people, who are all the players we need around the table, including the waste pickers, including the collection facilities, including the consumer goods companies, that it can then be scaled to national level. And then we want to replicate that in Southeast Asia as well. That gives me hope because it's moving. We had the idea in relatively few months ago and it's already happening. And similarly, seeing progress and being able to point to solutions is really, really exciting. So that's really exciting. And then you've got hopeful things like the Oceanography Museum in Monaco, which has like this future, like if you're traveling through the sea at like 300 meters below sea level, over time, like 2045, 2085, etc., and you're seeing the sea regenerate. And it's explaining why and what could be done. And things like that, just are really exciting projects that I think give people hope that we're actually starting to make some progress. So we just need to focus on that. And I think anyone who's working in this sphere is inherently glass half full kind of people. Yeah. So that's quite good too.
Yeah, that's the attitude that we need, definitely. Final question, we're almost at the end. Unfortunately, I could continue for hours. Can you give us an outlook towards your keynote on the summit of the German Design Council in Stuttgart?
Well, I mean, it's about knowing your audience, right? So thinking about who's going to be in the audience, who are the members of the German Design Council, and just really digging in a bit further as to how do you move from words to action? How do we focus more on the three areas that I mentioned that we're focusing on, and how people can get involved, and how do they fit into a value chain that helps them as an organization, but contributes to having a greater impact by being part of a bigger circle. That's really what I'm going to be talking about. So I'm really looking forward to seeing you and other people there.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm also looking forward to it. That was it, but that was really fantastic. A real pleasure.
It was a real pleasure too, Martin. It's really great. Ganz herzlichen Dank.
Gerne, gerne. What really stood out to me in my conversation with John Quill was her clarity around why circularity must sit at the very heart of business strategy and also everyday practice, not as a sustainability add-on, but as an economic and collaborative opportunity. I was particularly struck by her emphasis on rethinking how organizations work together, moving beyond traditional boundaries to really unlock systems change. And obviously, and perhaps the most inspiring, was her call to actively shape a positive future, reminding us that the future is not something that simply happens to us, but something that we all have a role in designing. We'd love if you subscribed to Design Perspectives. If you have questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to email us at podcast@gdc.de. Thanks for listening.
The Design Perspectives podcast is a production of the German Design Council.